Welcome to the AUKUS podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The topic of this issue is surgery of limbic and paralimbic gliomas, and the topic editor is Dr. Bernard Mayer of the Department of Neurosurgery at the Technical University of Munich in Germany. Joining Dr. Mayer in this month's dialogue is Dr. Hugues Dufour of the Department of Neurosurgery, Hôpital Guy de Chauillac in France. Dr. Dufour is also affiliated with the Institut National de la Santé et de la Recherche Médicale, Hôpital de la Colombière, Centre Hospitalier Universitaire de Montpellier. The article under discussion is entitled Functional Outcome After Language Mapping for Insular World Health Organization Grade 2 Gliomas in the Dominant Hemisphere, Experience with 24 Patients. It was written by Dr. Dufour along with Sylvie Moritz-Gasser and Peggy Gatignol.
Thank you very much for your contribution for this issue of neurosurgical focus. I mean, you summarize more or less 10-year experience in paralimbic glioma surgery, is that right?
Exactly. It was specifically a subgroup with patients harboring low-grade glioma within the dominant hemisphere, and then the goal was to speak not only about the paralimbic glioma surgery, but also the preservation of language and cognitive function using wig mapping.
So can you maybe tell us just a bit how you got involved? Were you primarily from the neuro-oncology side, or are you an epilepsy surgeon?
In the beginning, it was a training performed in Seattle, thanks to George Oshman in epilepsy, but I had the chance also to meet Mitch Berger, and then more and more I developed an activity dedicated to brain tumor surgery. And then now my experience is totally dedicated to brain mapping in oncology, even if, of course, we can have some good results also on epilepsy, because in 90% or at least 80% of cases in low-grade glioma, the first symptom is epilepsy.
Okay, maybe you can a bit elaborate on that, because a lot of people don't know how surgery influences epileptology and the outcome with respect to seizures. Can you give us a few numbers on what the seizure outcome is on the average for these people?
On average, we have more than 80% of good results on epilepsy, especially for grade 2 gliomas, because most of the time and the diagnosis is made for this kind of low-grade glioma due to seizures. And specifically in paralimbic and insular low-grade glioma, we have high rate of intractable epilepsy. Then the quality of life is not so good for this kind of patients. And thanks to surgery, even if it's not systematically possible, of course, to remove all the tumor, especially in paralimbic glioma and especially in the dominant hemisphere, we have nevertheless more than 80% of control of seizures and then improvement of the quality of life of patients.
Okay, so you would say seizures alone are a good indication to go forward and offer surgery to these patients, right?
Yes, definitely. And this kind of surgery has, to my opinion, not only an oncological impact, but also functional impact, and especially thanks to control of seizures.
Okay, this is exactly what we have experienced. Now, you are a very prominent promoter of surgery within the paralimbic system. Our group does that too. But still, a lot of people, even in the neurosurgical community, are rather reluctant to operate within the paralimbic system, because the fear is that morbidity and mortality rates are a lot higher than with other glioma surgery. According to us, this is not the case. What is your opinion on this?
I completely agree with you. It's now possible to have a very low rate of morbidity and mortality in this kind of surgery. Why? Because first of all, to my opinion, we have to perform subpial dissection, and then you have a very, very few risk to have problem with vessels, because you can preserve the vessels thanks to a preservation of the pia mater. The second point is to not only open the Sylvian fissure, because sometimes it's very difficult due to vein, but to remove some operculum, frontal, sometimes parietal or temporal operculum, in order to have better access to the insula. And it's possible, especially, of course, within the right non-dominant hemisphere, but also on the left dominant hemisphere, thanks to a cortical mapping at the level of the operculum. Third, because you have also possibility to preserve the pathways, and not only the motor pathways, thanks to MEPs to direct subcortical stimulation of the motor pathways, but also language pathways in the dominant hemisphere. And fourth, because if you preserve these pathways, then you are protected from the anterior perforating substance, which is probably, to my opinion, the most dangerous part of this kind of surgery with the paralambic system. And then you have a kind of protection because pathways, especially for language, are laterally located to the anterior perforating substance. So it's very, very rare now to have a deep stroke, and most of the time, patients are able to recover completely a normal life and even once again to improve the quality of life thanks to the resolution in 80% of cases of epilepsy.
Okay, this is also our experience, but what we both also agree on is that monitoring and mapping is essential in this kind of surgery. So can you maybe just describe a little bit what techniques you use for, let's say, a motor function monitoring and B, language monitoring?
For motor function, I think it's possible to use both direct cortical and subcortical stimulation and intraoperative monitoring, especially if you deal with surgery under general anesthesia in order to have an online control. Specifically now in the dominant hemisphere, and it was the goal of this paper in your surgical focus, I think that we have definitely to consider more systematically perform way mapping, because it's very easy for the patient to tolerate this kind of surgery. So the problem now is to have the good assessment, language and cognitive assessment during surgery, and to my opinion, it's very important to have a speech therapist or a neuropsychologist or a neurologist within the operative theater. Then, when the patient is awake, it's possible for him to perform online language and cognitive tasks throughout the resection and after, of course, cortical mapping. Once again, cortical mapping allow not only to remove the operculum if invaded by the tumor, which is very frequent in cases of paralambic tumor, but sometimes also to remove an operculum not infiltrated by the tumor, because the tumor is purely within the insula. And then you have a very good access, and I know it could be a little bit strange to remove a part of the brain not invaded by the tumor, but if this part is not functional, not crucial for the function, then you can improve your surgical access, and then after to perform the subchial dissection and to avoid to have a problem with the vessels. After, you have also to test the cortical surface of the insula, because everybody in neuroscience know that the insula is very important in the complex planning of articulation. Then we have a risk in low-grade glioma to the invasive feature of this kind of tumor to have crucial areas still functional within the tumor. In our experience, in insula or in other location, in low-grade glioma, in 15 to 20% of cases, we have a risk to find eloquent areas still crucial for the function. Then we have, of course, to identify this eloquent site before to remove the insula. And thereafter, we have also to identify the functional pathways, and for language it's a little bit more complicated than for just pyramidal pathways, because we have a dorsal root especially involved in articulation and phonological processing, and a ventral root especially dedicated to semantic processing. But once again, thanks to the collaboration with the patient and with the speech therapist during surgery, it's not so difficult with little training to have anatomical function functional correlation online, and then for the neurosurgeon to know exactly where we are, and then to say, now I am into the contact of crucial pathways, I have to avoid disconnectionism syndrome, and then I have to stop. And once again, lenticulostrate arteries are a little bit more deeper in a comparison to these pathways. And this is the reason why, really, in this specific experience in the left dominant hemisphere, the rate of permanent now morbidity is zero, because it's just methodological rigor during surgery, and of course the risk is not null, but it's very, very rare to have a complication when the patient is awake.
Functional mapping, especially language, I mean, it has become clear now to everybody and is more complex and more complicated, and also logistically. So where do you see the place of functional imaging, specifically fMRI or fiber tracking? Do you use it, and what is your opinion on this?
I use it systematically since more than 10 years for fMRI and more than 4 or 5 years for DTIs. Since the beginning. But I do not trust on the results. I mean, I know the limitations of this kind of imaging, and the goal is to combine in order to improve the reliability of fMRI and DTI. But actually, we know, especially for language, that it's not reliable, and it's not the neurosurgeon who's saying that, but the neuroscientist, because I have the chance to meet very regularly colleagues in the human brain mapping meeting, and they are the first to say, be careful, because fMRI is very useful to better understand brain processing, but at the individual scale, you have to be very cautious. The second point is much more for me to try to have a surgical approach, especially I had the chance to remove this operculum and then probably to have a better access to the insula. And third, to more and more use longitudinal study for the same patients, I mean fMRI and DTI before surgery, but also after surgery, a couple of years after the first intervention, when we know that it was not possible to remove completely the tumor, but with grade 2 glioma, a possibility to perform second surgery 5 years or 10 years after, and sometimes now more and more a third surgery without chemotherapy or radiotherapy. And the goal is to track the mechanisms of brain plasticity at the individual scale, because it's possible to change radically the map of the patient 5 years after a first surgery, thanks also to a specific rehabilitation. And of course, fMRI is non-invasive, and then I think it's very important to compare fMRI now to a first surgery 5 years before, and to say to the patient, you recruit the control lateral hemisphere, and then I have a chance to remove more this time if you agree to perform a second surgery. And actually, the rate of no said by the patient when I propose a second or a third surgery is, in my experience, zero.
I know of your interest in this. So these are longitudinal studies with functional imaging. So you're still gathering data on that and trying to get more experience. You don't have a publication out on that. Is that right? So you await the long-term results.
Yes, we had just a publication in other location within the ventral and the dorsal premotor cortex with longitudinal fMRI with successive surgeries and combined to intraoperative mapping, but not yet published regarding specifically the paralimbic system, because we have, of course, to increase a little bit our series and to improve also, once again, the quality of fMRI.
Yes.
Sometimes it's difficult now to compare fMRI a couple of years after, 5 years, 10 years, in comparison to the first MRI I performed 10 years ago, because the quality is completely different.
Yes.
So it's another methodological problem.
So we're looking forward to these results, to seeing these results, obviously, because I think, as I am aware, you're the only one doing this on a very systematic level. My last question, which is maybe the most difficult one, the mappings we use are maybe a bit more refined, but they're around for at least 40, 50 years. I mean, awake craniotomies and language mapping. Do you see anything in the future, any technology that might be replacing this more or less old-fashioned neurophysiological methods that we use now?
I think that for movement, maybe it's possible, once again, electrophysiology, MEPs, intraoperative monitoring. But for cognitive function, and especially language, it's very difficult to have a direct access to this kind of function just using curves. I mean electrophysiology during surgery under general anesthesia, or to use only, in my opinion, functional MRI due to the fact that, once again, we do not track directly using fMRI and neural events, but and the Bold effect. Of course, we have more and more to combine now with magnetoencephalography and to better understand the connectivity of the brain. But to be honest, I think it will be very difficult to replace, actually, to improve also the task performed during surgery. I mean, not only cognition, but more and more emotional component, very important for the quality of life of patients harboring this kind of lesion. I mean, able to live more than 10 years. And then we have to be very careful with not only the movement and the language and the cognition, executive function, but also probably with the behavior and the social component of young patients with a kind of normal life.
Well, thank you very much for your time and for your effort and contributing to this issue of neurosurgical focus and sharing with us your vast experience that you have.
This concludes our podcast for the August issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the September issue, when the topic will be Surgery of Eloquent Gliomas, Including Awake Craniotomy versus Extraoperative Mapping. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Call for Papers under the Neurosurgical Focus icon. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.